Hello, this is Albert Einstein. History myths fly around at the speed of light. Especially with that new internet thing you all seem to have. Thank goodness I have a direct connection to Professor Buzzkill, a fellow deep thinker who busts myths and takes names. I'm totally stoked there's a new episode. I was stuck on this new equation anyway. E equals MC something. Something.
Oh, Buzzkillers, we live in interesting times. There are so many questions about what's going on in contemporary politics that have historical background to them, and people are raising questions about why do we do this, and why have we always done it in the past? That's partly the subject of what we're talking about today, presidential removal and replacement. Why is it? How does it come about? What's the historical precedent for it? And unfortunately, with precedent, we have one of the consistently fantastic buzzkill experts in the bunker here, Professor Phil Nash from Penn State. How are you, Professor?
Doing all right. That's what my name tag says, consistently fantastic.
Consistently fantastic.
I'm going to trademark that.
Lovely and talented. And buzzkillers have asked me personally, both over the intersphere and by stopping me in the street and demanding that you come on the show and talk about this subject. Obviously, there's the question, there's the case of presidents being assassinated, and that's happened quite often, mm-hmm. considering all things considered in American history. But there's also this question of presidential removal and replacement. If they get sick, if they lose their minds, obviously right. lose their minds, and then how are they replaced? So what is this whole thing, and how have we wrestled with it throughout our history?
Very good question. Well, first of all, let me say what I'm not going to talk about, and that is the most obvious means of presidential removal, and those are elections.
Oh,
that's generally how
people seem to have forgotten about that. They're every 4 years,
quite a few incumbents have run for, I forget the number, but they've run for re-election and failed.
Yes, that's right.
That's not rare. I mean, yeah. we have had a lot of two-term presidents. Of course, we have term limits now, thanks to this 22nd Amendment, 1951. But elections are, and I always cite this when people talk about term limits.
Yeah,
and I always like to say, well, we have term limits. They're called elections. Now, there are some problems in the election process, for example, advantages of incumbency.
Yeah,
but nevertheless.
But it does happen remarkably often. Just to remind Buzzkill, President Bush the Elder.
Right. He was one of them.
President Carter
was one of them.
In a way, LBJ was one because he chose not to run again in 68.
Right. He was removed by his political circumstances, certainly.
But then there's a long period way back to Hoover, right?
Right. Like Calvin Coolidge, for example, could have run in 1928, decided not to. We still don't understand entirely why. William Howard Taft ran again in 1912, wasn't mm-hmm. reelected. Teddy Roosevelt, this is before the 22nd Amendment, could have run in 1908, decided not to, and immediately regretted it.
Right, and then tried again.
Right, and then, of course, Grover Cleveland, who is elected to two non-consecutive terms. I mean, there are all sorts of quirks and anomalies.
So, in fact, the easiest thing, what we're talking about is for presidential removal and replacement is elections,
right.
but we tend to forget that.
Right. Either elections or deciding not to run because of your political situation. So, obviously, apart from that, you've got the two sort of pillars of my comments today. One is going to be sort of impeachment/trial.
Okay.
And I would argue that's how you should say it, because that's one of the misconceptions. People use the word impeachment as shorthand for removal, and that's not accurate. So I would say impeachment/trial, and then also the 25th Amendment.
I remember witnessing Bill Clinton's impeachment at Aunt Ginger's house, very famously, and I walked in, and the vote had happened in the House of Representatives, and I went into the dining room where everyone was gathered, and I said, "He's been impeached." And they all looked at me, and they said, "Al Gore is president?" No. Well, it's actually the servants who all asked me that.
And you shook your head and said yourself, ignoramuses.
Yeah, yeah. In a few years, I'm going to have a podcast and set all of you straight.
Just you wait. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Article 2, Section 4 of our Constitution stipulates that the president, vice president, and other officers of the government shall be removed after they are impeached and convicted of either treason, bribery, or so-called high crimes and misdemeanors.
Yes, I thought bribery would be a high crime.
Right. And actually, that you raise, I think, one of the most important questions here, which is, I think a lot of people misunderstand what is meant by high crimes and misdemeanors, right?
Yeah.
Right. Doesn't that cover everything? So why would you go and list, like you say, why would you list treason and bribery? First of all, treason and bribery were considered by the founders to be like
the worst things.
Right.
Sure.
So big that they need to be separately listed. And then you've got your catch-all, which is high crimes and misdemeanors.
But misdemeanors, sorry to break the flow of things, but misdemeanors seems to be, you know, things you're picked up for as a teenager. You
That's
know,
it's,
it
right.
They seem to be very pathetically low for something as important as this.
My understanding is they're not using it in that sense.
Ah.
They use high crimes and misdemeanors basically to be as inclusive as possible.
Okay.
And
okay.
It's tacit recognition of a really important fact here, and that is that impeachment is not to be understood as a legal process, but as a political process.
Oh, now this is completely tearing down all the myths.
Right.
And
it's super important because especially in today's context, a lot of people will argue with the current or other recent presidents, well, they didn't break the law, therefore you can't remove them from office. It is not.
Okay.
I mean, I've heard a couple of experts on this, and they argue that this is not fundamentally a legal process.
Mm.
And for example, the two categories there's some overlap. But for example, you can have a president who commits a crime.
Yeah.
In other words, something you would be arrested by the police, tried, convicted, thrown in jail. That doesn't necessarily make it impeachable.
Okay.
And there are impeachable offenses that are not necessarily violations of the law, like, for example, abuses of power, right?
Yeah.
Like, if you abuse, I'm sure given enough time, you know, I could come up with a long list of abuses of power that are not technically violations of the law, quote unquote, the capital L law.
Yeah, I can see that technically.
Right.
Yeah, sure.
You know, like I said, abuses of power.
You overly influence a person or somebody or group of people,
right.
and it's not illegal, but it's sort of misusing what
right.
we understood to be
or
power.
If you somehow, I don't know, use the office for your personal benefit in a way that's not technically illegal, you might decide that that is an impeachable offense.
Okay.
But here, let me quote from the Wikipedia here.
Yes.
Covers allegations of misconduct peculiar to officials. In other words, this phrase, high crimes and misdemeanors.
Peculiar to
officials, such as perjury of oath. And by the way, perjury of oath, that would not necessarily technically illegal, right? You have an oath of office.
Yeah.
That's not mainly or entirely a legal question.
No, it's about the spirit of what you're trying to do.
Exactly right.
It's like the Boy Scout oath.
Exactly. Perjury of oath, abuse of authority, bribery, intimidation, right?
Intimidation, yeah.
Not necessarily illegal.
People could argue that LBJ did that all the time.
Exactly. Misuse of assets, failure to supervise, dereliction of duty. Once again, not technically illegal necessarily. Unbecoming conduct.
Right.
Refusal to obey a lawful order.
Uh-huh.
Offenses by officials also include ordinary crimes, but perhaps with different standards of proof and punishment than for non-officials, which is another thing, right? In other words, in the legal system, you might, quote-unquote, know someone is guilty of a crime, but if you can't prove it, they're in effect innocent.
Right.
In other words, you're like, for example, you don't have enough evidence.
Technically not guilty rather than innocent.
Right, and all the rules of evidence and stuff like that, and admissibility and things like that, those don't necessarily pertain to a political impeachment case. Right?
Okay.
There are different standards.
So it seems much easier to be impeached than it is.
in that sense, yes. In other words, different standards of proof and punishment than for non-officials on the grounds that more is expected of officials by their oaths of office.
Okay, and there comes that oath of the spirit of the... Okay.
Exactly.
Because unbecoming conduct could be all sorts of things.
Right. And for example,
failure to supervise?
Right. That's not necessarily a lack of a crime, but in other words,
just doing a bad job.
Or you hired someone and they're committing crimes and you're not doing anything about it. Like, for example, if you look at the way Harding handled the Teapot Dome scandal and some of these other scandals in the 1920s, he gets really low marks for the way he basically left this one guy who he knew was guilty skip town.
Yeah.
So Harding didn't do anything illegal there.
No.
But I could argue that that's an impeachable offense or something.
Failure to supervise.
Yeah, failure to supervise.
And
right?
dereliction of duty.
Right. So in other words, it's a political question and it's much broader. For example, I can imagine, I'm not being snide here, I can imagine a president who starts acting embarrassingly in public.
Yeah, right.
No
sure.
law against that.
But that would fall under unbecoming conduct.
Exactly.
Right.
You could argue that that's on its own, that might be legitimate grounds for removal.
Right. Okay. For removal under the impeachment process.
Exactly. Right. That's right. Under Article 2, Section 4. So, by the way, people should also be clear that you cannot impeach. It's quite clear. You cannot impeach and remove someone from office for something they did before they were in that office.
Right. Okay.
That's so, also really, really important. Even if they come to light while, later on. Right, while they're in office.
If in theory, if the land scandal under the Clinton's land scandal, Whitewater, yeah, that was when he was governor of Arkansas. So when he was president, it's not impeachable.
Right. Right. To put this another way, this is intended from the get-go as a political issue, not a legal issue. And it's intended as one of the checks and balances. In other words, it doesn't establish Congress as sort of this court that polices the legality of presidential behavior. It's giving Congress a lever over the executive in case the executive misbehaves.
Okay, well, see, I thought of it as this Congress being the sort of court. Right. Okay.
Well, and that's understandable because there is a trial, there is a procedure. I mean, it is court-like in a lot of ways, but it is not to be confused with our legal process. And I think that's where a lot of people run into trouble, where they define it very, very narrowly.
Okay.
And they act like if the president doesn't break the law, then the president is scot-free. That's not how it works, and that's not how it's supposed to work.
Okay. Well, it's certainly eye-opening to me.
Mm-hmm.
All that detail, especially.
The process is also meant to be difficult, and that's I give the founding fathers credit for that. Right, mm-hmm. You shouldn't be able to toss a president out just at the drop of a hat. And that's why I say that it's not just impeachment; it's impeachment and trial.
Right, right.
It's a deliberately designed 2-step process that involves first the House and then the Senate,
and so difficult that it hasn't ever happened.
Correct.
Yeah,
we've come close.
Yep, very close.
But we've come super close, but it has not happened. So what happens is the House, if the House thinks perhaps the president should be removed because of Troy's treason, bribery, or high crimes and misdemeanors, they start their process going and they come up with in effect a bill of charges.
Okay.
And they vote either to impeach or not to impeach.
Right.
All that means is if they say, yes, we vote to impeach, all they are saying is, this president should be tried by the Senate.
Okay.
In other words,
that's all impeachment really says.
That's all impeachment. Impeachment is not to be confused with removal of office. Yeah. It's necessary but not sufficient.
Right. So it's like a DA bringing charges in a criminal case.
Exactly. Right. Okay. It's like we're teeing it up. What happens after that? That's up to you. In this case, you being the U.S. Senate. So there have been 2 cases in history where a president was impeached. One is Andrew Johnson. I don't know if we ever want to do a show on Andrew Johnson. He is definitely one of our morbidly fascinating presidents.
Yeah, that's right.
No question.
Why he was even vice president is a whole complicated story.
That's a story of its own. Why is a Republican succeeded in office by a Democrat, for example?
Yeah, and apparently his type of Democrat
at the time.
That's
unique, I'm pretty sure. In any case, Andrew Johnson is famous or infamously our president after Abraham Lincoln is assassinated in April 1865. Yep. He is the president who presides over what we call Reconstruction.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hoping someday we do a Reconstruction show.
Yeah, you're stacking up the schedule here.
Sorry, I'm filling the hopper, but yeah, Reconstruction.
That's the way history is.
Yeah, Reconstruction deserves a show. Especially after the 1866 midterm elections, he is at loggerheads with the so-called radical Republicans who dominate Congress and are trying, and they do successfully to hijack the Reconstruction process from control of the president, because he is basically, in a nutshell, way too mild on the defeated South for their purposes.
And certainly in the eyes of the radical Republicans, he's way too South. Way too mild.
Oh, way too south.
And way too south.
Yes.
Tennessee.
And what ends up being the focal point is this so-called Tenure of Office Act,
mm-hmm.
which later version of it in the early 20th century is declared unconstitutional. And I can see why. The Tenure of Office Act basically says the president cannot remove a cabinet officer without Senate approval.
Which,
in terms of checks and balances, is sort of insane, because the president appoints cabinet officers, and now you're saying you can't remove one of these people?
Okay, is that's also probably effectively why they ask for the resignation rather than fire them.
That's right.
Yeah, okay. So cabinet officers resign rather than get the axe.
Right. This is a holdover. This is the person in who's at the center of this is Edwin Stanton, who was Lincoln's Secretary of War, who was still in the office, and Johnson wanted to get rid of him, and the Radical Republicans wanted to keep him, and so they passed this Tenure of Office Act.
Stanton is in everything. It just seems to be involved in absolutely everything, including the Lincoln movie.
Yeah, he's an important dude.
We should have a show on him.
That Stanton show. So Johnson, understandably, does not abide by the Tenure of Office Act.
Yeah.
He violates it, and so they use that as the main grounds to impeach the House.
And that's clearly breaking the law, because he's breaking this act.
That's right.
Right, okay.
Right, which was put into law over his veto. So it was law.
Oh, right, okay.
Right. So the House votes 128-47 to impeach. Mm-hmm. So then they hand him over to the trial, to the Senate for trial in 1868, a three-month trial. And the Senate votes 35-19. There's several votes. All of them were 35-19 in favor of removal.
And if
people are wondering, like, okay, yeah, so why wasn't he removed? That's one vote shy of a two-thirds majority, which is what you need.
Oh, that's right. That's
which,
part of the
which is another right. deliberate, relatively high barrier to removal, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. Which you can't have a majority. You have to have a supermajority. And there are other cases like that. For example, ratification of treaties, where you take two-thirds of the Senate. Mm-hmm. They raised the bar. And I'm pretty sure they actually brought in at least one senator on a cot from the hospital so he could vote. So this was a big deal. And so the good news for Andrew Johnson is he gets to stay president. Did not run for re-election in 1868.
Oh, and sure, yeah.
Yeah, but he was not removed from office. That's the closest we've come.
Right.
One more vote and he would have been removed.
Right.
And by the way, the president would have been the president pro tem of the Senate, because Johnson did not have a vice president, not for his entire presidency. We'll talk about that later. Second, more famously and much more recent, is Bill Clinton, mm-hmm, in the context of the Lewinsky scandal and also the Paula Jones scandal, late 1998. Clinton is...
Can I ask you one quick question? Wasn't the Paula Jones scandal before he became president, though?
Yes,
opened up all this.
But also, I think he allegedly perjured himself about that,
which he
case.
Did when he was president. Okay.
Exactly. So he did testify under oath as president. That's what
so it's not
trouble.
Surprising that Aunt Ginger's servants and everyone were all confused when I said he's been impeached, because it's all very complicated.
That's right. So the House does vote an article of impeachment on perjury and then another article on obstruction of justice. They pass...
I forgot the obstruction part.
Yeah, not overwhelmingly. There were two other articles of impeachment, which I forget what they were, but they failed. So there were four total. And by the way, it was not strictly along party lines. There were some, at least a few Democrats who voted, I'm sorry, at least a few Republicans who voted not to impeach.
In the House. These votes are very close.
They are very close. 228-206 and 221-212.
Wow.
I'm pretty sure the Republicans were still in charge of the House at this point.
Yes, that's right.
After the Gingrich Revolution of 94. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, as I recall, that's one of the reasons why Gingrich was forced to step down as Speaker.
Because he didn't get it done.
Yeah, because this whole thing. Yeah. Well, and also that he had brought this up, and that clearly, if you look at the opinion polling, the impeachment was not very popular. And the Democrats actually picked up seats in the 1998 midterm elections, which is the midterm elections in a second term of president usually doesn't go very well for the party in power. It actually went pretty well in that time for the Democrats. So then there's a Senate trial in 1999 on the perjury count, 55 vote to acquit. So 55 acquit, 45 guilty. That fails.
Right.
Obstruction, the vote is 50-50.
Right.
But once
That's
again,
certainly not two-thirds. Yeah.
Not even close. All Democrats voted to acquit, and a few Republicans voted to acquit.
Right.
So he stayed in office.
So he stays in office but they both, Johnson and Clinton, go through the whole process.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
They are both tried in the Senate.
And I think one of the reasons, at least for the Clinton midterm successes or the Democrat midterm successes, is a lot of people were very blamed the Republicans
exactly.
for dragging the country through this.
That's right. And didn't think that these were impeachable offenses.
Right, right.
And that's still subject to debate, obviously.
Oh, sure. Everyone's still alive.
Well, yeah. So and then there's the once again the dog that did not bark, and that's Richard Nixon, who
removes himself from office, but I would argue that the, and not just me, the overwhelming reason why he removes himself from office is that he would have been removed from office. The House voted.
Okay.
And of course, this is all about Watergate. There's, by 1974, the focus of Watergate is the struggle over the White House tapes.
Mm-hmm.
Because obviously, if you're investing in Watergate, you want to know famously what did the president know and when did he know it.
Sure,
so you want the tapes from these key conversations, which he's not willing to share. He thinks they're his own personal property.
Yeah.
There's also the Saturday Night Massacre at the end of 73 when Nixon fires the attorney general and the deputy attorney general because they won't fire the Watergate special prosecutor, Archibald Cox.
Right.
People probably know about that. At the very end of his administration, in the last week or two of his administration, July, August 1974,
Before
he's decided to resign, okay. There are people around him who, and this is just sort of a side note, the people around him who worry about his stability. The Secretary of Defense, James Schlesinger, we now know very clearly, told the Joint Chiefs of Staff to ignore any presidential order that doesn't have his, Schlesinger's, all signature as well.
Oh, okay.
That is not constitutional.
Yeah.
I'm pretty clear about that. Anyway, and once again, and it raises, as we'll see later, it raises this whole 25th Amendment issue, which
yeah.
is, you know, if you think the president is incapacitated, there's a legit procedure for that. You're not allowed to do this sort of thing on the sly. You may be well-intended.
Yeah, sure.
Right? You don't want
nuclear war to start.
Yeah, exactly. Without, yeah. You don't want a potentially crazy president to, on his own authority, launch a nuclear war, an authority which the president essentially has, unfettered.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
In any case, this was once called the most patriotic act of treason.
What Schlesinger did,
which I think is a great quote. So the House Judiciary Committee, which at least in this case is where the impossible impeachment starts, the House Judiciary Committee approved three articles of impeachment.
Against Nixon.
Obstruction of justice, abuse of power, and contempt of Congress.
Mm-hmm.
There were, similar to Johnson, similar to Clinton, there yeah. were two articles of impeachment that were rejected. One was the bombing of Cambodia.
Oh, yeah.
Which is interesting.
Vietnam episodes.
That's right. And also failure to pay his taxes.
Yeah.
Because it's often overlooked because of the magnitude of Watergate. But
oh,
there
sure,
was
yeah.
also personal corruption in the case of Nixon. I'm pretty sure, by the way, that he used official funds to help renovate his place in San Clemente.
We do that all the time here.
Mm. Wait, you have a place in San Clemente too?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Wow. So we're almost neighbors. So, yeah, so the Cambodia bombing and failure to pay his taxes, those were not passed as
right, okay,
articles of impeachment in the House Judiciary Committee.
He could have had five.
Could have had five, but he got to, so he only had three.
Okay.
That's the good news for him.
Yeah, right, yeah, yeah.
The bad news is that obstruction, abuse of power, and contempt of Congress, those all passed.
Yeah.
It is clear from everything I've seen, and you asked about the trigger. The trigger of his resignation is that politicians went to him privately and said, look, you don't have the support on Capitol Hill.
That's right.
This goes ahead, you will be impeached. And if you're impeached, you'll be tried and found guilty
right.
by the Senate. Because remember, in the Senate, I forget what the numbers are, but you still have one of the reasons why you have the Watergate hearings is that the 1972 election, even though it's a blowout for Nixon, Democrats retain control of the House and Senate.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
A huge deal in that context. Because, of course, then Sam Ervin is the chair of the Special Watergate Committee.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty clear to us, and it was clear to Nixon at the time, that he would have been impeached, he would have been convicted and removed, and that's the reason he resigned. And I wouldn't call it a myth, but if you look at what Nixon says at the time and what a lot of Nixon supporters say, they say things like, well, he didn't want to drag the country through this.
Yeah.
But the country had been through enough. It's essentially what Gerald Ford said when he pardons Nixon, right? We need to put this behind us,
sure.
right? We can't have a president on trial and then sent to jail.
Yeah.
Right? Our long national nightmare is over, whatever he said. So Nixon came up with all sorts of explanations as to why he stepped down. He's not even a little bit honest about the truth, which is he removed himself because he was going to be removed.
Right.
So that's...
Yeah, so they just had to happen. Well, Nixon realized it had to happen. Well, from his own standpoint, if he did it, it would probably be better than if he was removed by the outside power, which is the Congress.
That's right. So, in other words, the bottom line here is, just speaking hypothetically, I believe it's more likely a president will remove themselves from office because they're facing likely impeachment mm-hmm. and conviction. I think that's more likely than actual impeachment and conviction, right?
Right.
In other words,
right.
the president sees the writing on the wall, as Nixon did, and just decides, well, what's the point?
And it is more likely because right. it actually happened. The other two cases, right. it didn't happen.
Yeah. And right. by the way, and this may sound, I'm just freelancing here, this may sound cynical, but then you can claim you did it for other reasons.
If
you
are, true. Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
If you are impeached and convicted, everyone knows why you were, right? In other words, you were dragged, kicking, and screaming because you were impeached
yeah.
and convicted. If you do it like this, you can say, oh, I'm doing it for the country.
Right. Okay. Right. Well, there's another thing we need to do for the country and for the world, and that is take a sponsorship break to not only highlight the great work that our sponsors are doing, but to move on from impeachment to the 25th Amendment when we get back. Okay, we're back. Professor, if impeachment and removal wasn't complicated enough, we now have this new thing, relatively new.
Relatively.
Called the 25th Amendment, which is a way to remove a president. That's much more complicated, it seems to me.
Oh, yeah. I was shocked at how complicated this is.
It comes up a lot in the news these days. That is 2018. But my goodness, it's the history and the background is complicated, but the actual amendment is very complicated.
And can I sort of reiterate what I've done before, which is sort of my mixed message about the founding fathers, you know, mm-hmm. justifying the B- that I give to the founding fathers, which is...
That keeps them off the honor roll.
Much better than a gentleman C. In other words, on the one hand, on the other hand, this is one of the cases where they made a pretty big mistake, I think, or a big crime of omission, as I would call it. But on the other hand, in the big picture, I give them huge credit for having the humility to put in place an amendment process.
Yes, oh, right? Absolutely.
I mean, because, you know, they were... Some of them were full of themselves. These were very accomplished people, super bright. They were leading this new country. Some of them very, very certain about what they were doing. You can imagine them saying, this document is so awesome that we'll just sort of leave it as it is.
Yeah.
But they recognize that future generations, that they have no idea what they will look like, mm-hmm. might find the need to adapt. And by the way, they do amend it 10 times immediately. Yeah,
before it gets ratified, right?
No.
Oh, no, it was ratified right afterwards. Then, okay.
Well, yeah, it got ratified in places like New York because they promised it would be immediately amended with a Bill of Rights.
Yeah. So there's kind of a state pressure. States make pressure on
absolutely.
The federal government.
Yeah, because they really had to have New York ratify at that point in 1788. Anyway, so they recognize, and of course, after those initial 10 amendments, we've done it another 17 times.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
A lot of them I couldn't even name, like the most recent one, the 27th. Do you know what that one is? I've forgotten.
No, but Prohibition is the famous one because it gets on and then removed.
Well, I think, right, there are two on that one issue. So here the case is about the 25th Amendment.
Right.
Which not only is it shocking that we need this, it's shocking that it happens so late.
Yes, within our lifetimes.
Barely. Yeah. So you and I can call ourselves 25th Amendment babies?
Yeah, that's right.
I'm going to get a t-shirt. You watch.
Yeah.
So it's introduced in 1965, goes into effect 1967, 25th mm-hmm. Amendment. It's clear, like I said, clearly a case where the Constitution is flawed, and we can't anticipate everything, but there had been some stories kicking around for a long time that seemed to justify this, like the story of Woodrow Wilson in 1919, which
we talked about in our Wilson show.
Debunked that. I argue that the idea that his wife was the president, that's kind of exaggerated.
Yeah.
It's quite clear that he was incapacitated.
Oh, sure.
And that the public was kept in the dark about that.
Yeah.
And that that's a case where an acting president should have been put in place, in this case, the vice president.
Right. Right.
But still, that's a kind of case where you can make a really good case that, like I said, you should have had an acting president for several months. So the 20th Amendment is put in place. It's got four sections. Section 1 we'll call presidential succession.
Mm-hmm.
And what Section 1 did is it codified the so-called Tyler precedent. And I didn't even know this. This refers to John Tyler.
Yeah, this goes way back.
Way back. This is 1841.
Right.
When
we think about the whole sweep of American history, it's not that long after the Constitution.
That's
it's
right.
It's only 40 years after.
Correct.
40, 50 years after the Constitution.
Correct. And I had thought that the basic presidential succession.
Yeah.
In other words, president dies, vice president takes over permanently. I thought that was sort of in black and white. It's not.
No.
The Constitution is actually a little bit vague on this. So the famous William Henry Harrison, president for 5 weeks.
Yeah, yeah.
We're not going to do a show on him, I'm thinking. But maybe a mini myth.
Yeah. 5 minute show.
Sorry.
On a 5 week
president.
Sorry,
Bill, you don't deserve a full show. You weren't president long enough. He dies in office, and then his vice president, John Tyler, becomes president. No one disputed that, but it wasn't clear whether that was an acting or a permanent move. In other words, is he just acting president for the rest of the term, or is he permanent president immediately upon succeeding?
Well,
the Constitution is vague on that.
Yeah, I thought this happened because Tyler himself, I mean, it became a president because Tyler himself sort of made sure that he became president in both in title and in action.
Right. In other words,
he acted like the president.
And then everyone gets used to the idea that he's not an acting president, but actually the new president.
Yeah.
And so the Constitution was vague on that. Section 1 of the 25th Amendment clarifies that if the president dies, not only does the vice president succeed, but the vice president becomes the new capital P president, not acting, but permanent. And it was as if that person had been elected president.
Right. Okay. Right.
So this clarifies that. Right there, I think that's useful.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'd hate to think we'd like
plugged a hole.
Exactly. We'd like relitigate that. The section 2 is, I would argue, another oversight of the founders.
Yeah.
Which in this refers to vice presidential vacancy.
Ah, because of course we talked about after Andrew Johnson became president after Lincoln. Andrew Johnson didn't have a vice president.
That's right. Exactly. Then what? And that's something that was very much on people's minds in 1965, because we mentioned this in another show. Between November 22nd, 1963, and January 20th, 1965, we also had no vice president.
Oh, you mean when LBJ became president after the assassination, but then he went through all of 64 without a vice president?
No, wow. Veep. I always just assumed that he had appointed Hubert Humphrey, but that was a stupid assumption on my part. Hubert Humphrey is chosen as his running mate.
Oh, so Humphrey stays in the Senate for all of 64.
That's right.
Until Inauguration Day 65.
That's right.
Wow.
Yep. And yeah, so he does not become vice president until January 1965 when we go that space. It was not as long as the space when Andrew Johnson had no vice president.
Yeah.
So we have, I can imagine, numerous cases where we might have ended up with the Senate, president pro tem of the Senate as president of the United States.
Right.
Because that's the next person in line.
Wow.
Kind of odd that they wouldn't think of this, but this requires a new president who has succeeded to the presidency to immediately nominate a vice presidential replacement who then has to be approved by the Congress.
So that means when Nixon resigned and Ford became vice president, who had himself been appointed because Agnew had resigned, Ford had to immediately pick a new
vice president, Nelson Rockefeller.
Oh, okay.
Who then, by the way, just while we're on the subject, was unceremoniously dumped from the Republican ticket in 1976.
Because Bob Dole was put on.
Right, they brought in Bob Dole, who would have been the vice president had Ford been elected in 1976, which was, by the way, could have happened. That was a really close election.
Ford Carter, yeah.
Yeah, he closed the gap. But yes, and that's why Gerald Ford famously is our only president to have been elected neither vice president nor president.
Yeah, that's right. And presumably Rockefeller's the only vice president to never been elected. Vice president, because he'd been governor.
Well, apart from Ford. Ford himself. Right?
Oh, yeah.
They're both appointed.
We're getting into the weeds here, Buzzkillers.
It's easy to lose track.
I can hear radios turning off all around the world.
he lost me with that Gerald Ford thing. So Gerald Ford really is an anomaly. But that's how it's supposed to work. You're not supposed to go any length of time really at all without a vice president.
Right. Okay.
Right. So that Section 2 of the 25th Amendment tidies that up. And like I said, I was certainly surprised just the number of cases and the length of time in our history when we have been without a vice president.
Okay, well, these two sections, sections 1 and section 2, are fairly common sensey, right? These are like...
Sure. Right.
Who
would dispute these?
Yeah. Sections 3 and 4 get a little bit more, you know, not dicey, but are certainly more...
A lot murkier, no question.
This is, again, Section 3 and 4 of the 25th Amendment. we're talking about.
Right. So, because this doesn't deal, this does not deal with the questions of presidential removal, either through resignation or conviction by the Senate in a trial, or premature death, like assassination or death from illness. This deals with presidential incapacity.
Okay, right.
Which might be routine or might not be routine. For example, there are, like, for example, when Reagan was shot in March of 1981.
Yeah.
There's a period where he was not able to execute the duties of his office. And so then this kicks in, and then the vice president, I think it happened in that case, the vice president is temporarily in charge.
But he's not made acting president. He's just still vice president, but he's just in charge while Reagan's under anesthetic.
No, I think he is acting president at that point.
Oh, no kidding. Okay.
Yeah. And for even if, I think it happened to Carter, if the president undergoes surgery...
Yeah,
and is put under general anesthetic. Obviously, they can't execute the duties of the office.
No, no.
Even if it's just for a few hours, and so there will be a declaration under Section 3. So it says basically that when the president transmits a written declaration to the president pro tem of the Senate and the Speaker of the House, who, by the way, are numbers 2 and 3 in the succession.
Right.
Stating that he is unable to discharge the powers and duties of the presidency. Until the president sends another written declaration to the aforementioned officers declaring himself able to resume discharging those powers and duties, the vice president discharges those powers and duties as acting president. So basically, it provides for an on-off switch. Or should I say off-on switch?
So the only time this has really been used is, as you say, when Reagan got shot and Carter went under. It was kind of... Eisenhower had kind of... sort of establish it as a practice.
Right.
Or
de facto precedent.
Yeah. When he had Howard, like, what's always strange to me about this section is that the president declares himself able to resume discharging. Now, if a president gets shot or has a surgery or has a heart attack, you know, public opinion might say, look, you're not ready to come back, but if he says he is, then he is.
That's right.
So if a president goes bananas, right, and must, you know, go to the funny farm for a few months,
doesn't know he's gone bananas, is often the thing about going bananas.
But then he has to say, all he has to do is say, I'm not bananas anymore, mm-hmm. let me back, and at least part of Section 3, now Section 4 might kick in and eliminate that. We'll talk about that in a minute. But under Section 3, he can come back.
Right. And that's why it's important that we have Section 4, because I think Section 3 by itself could conceivably cause some problems of the type you just described.
Yeah, okay.
Which is, it could be everyone else decides that this is a bad idea, the president coming back into office after whatever just happened.
Yeah.
But if the president decides, no, I'm good, then we could be in real trouble. Now, of course, conceivably, then you could impeach, right?
Oh, okay.
Right. You're not carrying out the duties of your office.
Because you're loony tunes or whatever.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And so you would have that safety valve. But in addition to that, we now also have Section 4, which is
Before we get into Section 4, it seems to me almost in a lot of these things, we're getting back to this point that you made at the very beginning of the show, which is that a lot of these devices are not legal. I mean, they are legal in a way, but they are also political, because the politics of declaring the president not bananas is going to rule the day.
That's right, and that does not take place in a vacuum.
Right.
To put it another way.
Yeah. It's not just because your doctor says so. It's not just because
your
doctor might say no.
Right.
And you could say yes, I'm perfectly fine. And I want the codes back,
right.
The nuclear codes
back. And you can imagine a case like that where maybe the president and maybe even also the president's doctor says, yeah, she's fine. She can do this. But you might have overwhelming public opinion and like 90% of the public and enormous pressure on Congress.
Mm.
No, she's not fit. You need to get rid of her. Right.
Yeah.
Then what? Right. It could be really, really complicated and might lead, like I said, to impeachment conceivably.
So, but those two things, either impeachment or the Section 4, which we'll talk about after the station ID break, would have to kick in.
That's right.
So the country could be kind of dragged through another whole
thing. Oh, I can imagine with the media involved and everything, it could be an incredible mess.
Crikey. Well, Buzzkillers, Let's talk about something fun, which is about the ways in which you can subscribe to Professor Buzzkill, tell all your buddies about Professor Buzzkill, and basically boost our listenership. And back in a minute.
This is Mary Todd Lincoln. President Lincoln is indisposed at the moment, but he asked me to remind you that Professor Buzzkill is part of Entertainment One's podcast network and is available on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, and all major podcast apps. Please subscribe and leave him a review. Please also go to ProfessorBuzzkill.com to support him on Patreon, to subscribe to his email notifications, and to shop the Buzzkill bookshelf. Follow him on Facebook, on Twitter at BuzzkillProf, and on Instagram at ProfessorBuzzkill. Thanks for listening.
All right, we're back. Well, we hope you'll take all of those things into account, how to find us on Facebook and Twitter and all that sort of stuff, and we'll become even more famous than we are. But Professor Nash, we've gone through a few of the ways in which presidents can be removed and replaced. Now we come to the final one, which seems almost to be the most difficult.
The, the money section, I'm going to call it.
Maybe impeachment and trial is the most difficult, but this sounds, Section 4 of the 25th Amendment sounds fraught
those
difficult
those impeachment and removal by trial end up pretty being pretty straightforward compared to this. So first of all, this is the only part of the amendment that has never been invoked,
right? Okay, yeah,
maybe that's a good thing. It allows the vice president, together with a quote majority of either the principal officers of the executive departments or of other such body as Congress may by law provide. Which is really interesting. So in other words, hypothetically, what happens in that case? Congress says, no, we either won't or can't impeach you, but we're going to vote into law, and presumably with a veto-proof majority, some new body that will determine this president's fitness to remain in office.
Okay, because when we hear about the 25th Amendment bandied around in the media, we always hear the cabinet.
That's right.
Which would be the principal officer of the executive departments. But this or some such body...
Right.
Is completely different.
Yeah, what's up with that? Wait, so, special congressional commission on presidential removal or presidential fitness?
So if they all go...
The other presidential fitness award.
If they all go bonkers, if the president goes bonkers and the whole cabinet goes bonkers and they're all sent to an institution, Congress would, you know...
Yeah, I think... At least I hope... That's when Congress would step up and invoke that little clause there.
Right, I'm going to get in trouble with the mental health community by saying bananas and
bonkers.
So I apologize for that now.
Yeah, good
but
point.
Everyone knows.
Yep. Good point.
What I mean, mentally ill and unable to carry out the duties of the office.
Right. So it allows the vice president, like I said, together with the majority of cabinet officers or other such body as Congress may by law provide, to declare the president, quote, unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office, end quote, by submitting a written declaration to the president pro tem of the Senate and the Speaker of the House.
As the president pro tem of the Senate is a leader of the Senate, right?
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the person you always see them. Well, actually, they switch the person who's actually presiding.
That's right. But you see them behind the president.
That's right, with the gavel. That's right.
Yeah,
it's exactly. It's a president pro tem of the Senate and then also the Speaker of the House, so the two seats. That's deliberate. As with Section 3, the vice president would become acting president, not president, and the sitting president would not be removed from office.
Okay. Now, presumably, this is the first time acting president is named in the Constitution or as a concept.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Section 4 is meant to be invoked should the president's incapacitation prevent him from discharging his duties, but he is unable or unwilling to provide the written declaration called for by Section 3.
Okay. Now, this could be lots of things.
Right. Exactly.
Being shot and being gravely injured, but not dead.
Right. So, in a way, this could just be the mundane extension of the process by which the vice president is the acting president. Right.
Uh-huh.
In other words, let's say he comes out of anesthetic, but the surgery didn't go well.
Right. Yeah.
The president still isn't fit, so we need to extend this. Right.
Yeah.
So, and that's how you could do this. Should the vice president and a majority of the cabinet believe the president is still unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office, they may, within 4 days of a president's declaration, submit another declaration that the president is incapacitated.
Now, we're reading these things off, Buzzkillers, because the specific language of this matters.
Yes.
And what it's certain complicated. Triggers are happening. And it's complicated.
Right.
And certain triggers happen in certain ways, in certain orders, because of the way this is written.
Right. If not already in session, the Congress must then assemble within 48 hours. So they thought of that.
Yeah.
The Congress has 21 days to decide the issue. If within 21 days, two-thirds of each House vote that the president is incapacitated, the vice president would quote-unquote, continue to be acting president. Should the Congress resolve the issue in favor of the president or make no decision within 21 days, so I guess the equivalent of a pocket veto, then the president would resume discharging the powers of and duties of his office. The use of the words continue and resume imply the vice president remains acting president while Congress deliberates.
Right.
So my understanding of this is no matter what, under Section 4,
yeah.
the vice president can never become president.
No, he's just
only
acting
president, even if it's for a lengthy period.
All the while the in theory, debilitated president is sitting right. there waiting to get back
That's
in.
That's right.
Okay.
So now this, now it says, by the way, the last thing here, the president may again submit a written declaration of recovery to the president pro tem and speaker of the House. That declaration could be responded to by the vice president and the majority of the cabinet in the same way as stated earlier. So I guess it provides for the sort of ongoing debate. Yes, I'm fit. No, you're not. Yes, I'm
yes,
fit.
Yes, that's right.
Right?
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
And that ball could be kicked around indefinitely under the terms of this, as far
yeah.
as I understand
well,
it.
Well, there's certainly this 21 days part of Congress, but yes,
right.
that's the written document
right.
is different.
And, you know, what's, to my mind, left unspoken here is the possible complications. You know, what if you have, for example, a really ambitious vice president who sees
yeah.
his or her opportunity
yeah.
and can manage to talk? By the way, and it doesn't say which cabinet officers. You could have
principal officers, right?
Right, they're all cabinet officers. You could have, you know, if the vice president is ambitious and gets, I don't know, not to sort of denigrate these offices, but HUD and transportation and energy.
Yeah, that's right.
They could
yeah.
overrule state and defense and justice.
Right.
I mean, right? I mean,
extremely important.
It doesn't say, right? They're not given a point value in terms of their vote, as long as you get a majority of the cabinet.
Wow. And the cabinet is big now, and it always seems to be getting bigger.
Right. So can you imagine the sort of politicking, or let's say the vice president has no such designs, but there might be some people on the outside
mm-hmm.
who are sort of looking at this as an opportunity to start lobbying people to vote one way or another. Yes, yes, incapacitated. No, not incapacitated.
Oh.
I mean, can you imagine? And you can imagine if this is all playing out in the media at the same time.
Yeah, the politics of this
right?
never stops.
Oh, yeah, exactly. It's like, you know, asking people on the street, do you think the president is fit? Or what do you think they should do? I mean, what a can of worms.
So this has never happened, of course. It's still a young amendment.
Right.
Right. Is it a way that the government, it couldn't be a way the government's overthrown, but is it a way that the president could be overthrown in a sense?
I could imagine it. I think it's highly unlikely,
mm-hmm.
and I'm certainly hoping it would never happen. But I could conceive of a scenario where whether the president is fit is subject to debate.
Yeah.
And that their quote-unquote fitness or non-fitness no longer becomes the main or even the only issue at stake. In other words, it becomes about power.
Holy
cow. It becomes about maybe, let's say, for example, I can imagine a situation where the president is either temporarily or long-term incapacitated or their capacity is in dispute, but they're also really unpopular.
Yes, that's right.
Right?
Yeah,
maybe people in the party say, wow, here's our chance to get rid of this person who we couldn't otherwise get rid of.
And so let's round up the HUD secretary and the forestry secretary.
Right.
Not forestry, Department of the Interior.
Agriculture or whatever. And the vice president say, look, you all need. I know you may have your doubts about the president's incapacity, but you need to take a hit for the team, which in other words,
we need to
do what's right for the country and the party.
Yeah.
Right. Mr. Vice President or Ms. Vice President, you need to be willing to step in because it's the right thing for the country, even though the president doesn't understand that.
Mm.
I can imagine a scenario like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I shudder to think about it, actually.
Well, it would mean we'd have a very, very complicated and very, very dramatic few months, maybe even a year
of
politics in the United States.
And you can imagine, like, deciding, like, okay, which doctors get to examine the president?
Yeah, oh,
which shrinks? Which, I mean, really?
They always, well, the public perception is often that they always disagree anyway.
Right.
And there are so many conditions now that you could label debilitating or not.
Right.
And on and on.
And I don't trust this guy with all his degrees hanging on his wall to determine who my president is.
And who's a Democratic doctor and who's a Republican doctor.
Exactly. Wow. Right. Exactly. Especially in a particularly partisan time period.
Yeah, yeah.
Goodness gracious.
Yeah. Well, Buzzkillers, as Professor Nash says, we certainly hope it doesn't happen, but if it does, it'll be interesting, to say the least.
And you'll hear about it here last.
That's right. Because yeah. Wait for the history to all settle itself out. And we'll talk to you next week.